Welcome to Dispatches, the official podcast for the Journal of the American Revolution. The Journal of the American Revolution publishes weekly online at www.allthingsliberty.com. For the latest in research, reviews, and commentaries, America's most important history is available free of charge at the Journal of the American Revolution.
How the environment just shifts pretty dramatically. But when you look at the history of it, the defeat of two of Continental armies in Charleston and then Camden, that just devastated the Continental forces. So increasingly, that small band is augmented by a number of militia.
That's Journal of the American Revolution contributor Jerry Krieger, discussing the British miscalculation of Loyalist support in the American South. And he's our guest today. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Dispatches. This episode is sponsored by the Small Battle series, with two new releases, The Battle of Musgrove's Mill, 1782, by John Buchanan, and The Battle of Harlem Heights, 1776, by David Price. Available now wherever books are sold. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Dispatches. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. Today our guest is Journal of the American Revolution contributor Jerry Krieger, and he's going to be discussing British miscalculation of Loyalist support in the American South. Jerry Krieger is going to hit on a lot of important themes about the American Revolution in this interview. One of the most important is just how understudied and how complicated the war is in America's southern colonies, Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina especially. We're very comfortable with battles of Bunker Hill and Saratoga, Long Island, and Brandywine in most cases when we study the American Revolution, but we balk a little bit at places like Kings Mountain, 96, Musgrove Mill, and Morris Creek, because the line is blurred. In many of these places, you have Americans fighting Americans. In the South, the American Revolution is largely a civil war, a terrible and brutal partisan conflict. Jerry Krieger brings that to life spectacularly in his new article. As always, you can find all of these articles at www.allthingsliberty.com. And I encourage you to read those articles. We have a brand new revamped website. Jerry Krieger is going to take us through some of the details of life and war in the southern colonies, and we'll turn it over to him. So sit back, relax, and enjoy our interview with Jerry Krieger. Jerry Krieger, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I look forward to discussing this interesting topic.
Jerry, you've never been on the show before. It's your first time. Tell us about your background.
I am recently retired last year, June. I served 30 years in the military, United States Army. I was a logistics officer, but I also served as a command military historian. And I just have a passion for military history that began when I started going to the United States Army War College. And then from there, I had some advisors that I wanted to do war studies and get my doctorate. And they said, well, you should do multidisciplinary. So I ended up getting a doctorate in international relations and doing a little bit of China stuff, but I'm trying to come back to my passion now that I've retired and just pursue the American Revolution in particular with the anniversary coming up. It's very exciting.
Jerry, what made you want to write this article?
I did some work a couple of years ago with the National Museum of the United States Army cataloging battles for the American Revolution for the 250th anniversary. And I was just enthralled with the Southern theater. And I know most people don't read much about it. I know in some of my military courses on the American Revolution, we didn't really talk about that as much, you know, Saratoga, Philadelphia campaign. So I started doing some research and did a paper on Nathaniel Greene's leadership that culminated in the Battle of Guilford Courthouse. And I just looked at all the steps that kind of led up to that, which was just absolutely fascinating. And just the role of militia, the partisan leaders, Francis Marion, Sumter, Pickens, and cavalry mounted troops. And I just couldn't stop reading. So I kept looking for more and more, and, read Greene's famous quote, "We fight, get beat, rise, and fight again," as I was working on the article, just piqued my interest. And then I read something about the Scottish Highlanders with broadswords trying to cross a bridge and getting mowed down. And it sounds so Hollywood. I had said, well, I've got to kind of do some more research on this and kind of call this out.
Jerry, could you explain to us what were the feelings of Southerners toward the British during the Revolution?
It's very interesting, and obviously it's mixed as it was across the colonies, but it was a little bit more unique because you had a lot of Scottish immigrants that settled in the Piedmont, and you had the Regulator movement, which was something else, but Scottish Highlanders kind of settled in there, and even after the war, they would leave for Canada, right? So they remained loyal, but due to shifting winds and, you know, the Patriot persecution, right, which was pretty strong, and then the lack of British support, right? So they kind of fell into the wayside. That was it was always true. And, you know, Josiah Martin will talk about in a little bit. He kept up this focus on the loyalist support. And we'll talk a little bit later about, his couple attempts. He was involved in the first one and the second. When you look at the Americanization of the American Revolution and how the British, you know, were running short of troops, France is in the war, and they got to defend the Caribbean. So they said, well, you know, we're going to count on these loyalists. And there was Martin, you know, telling Lord General Cornwallis, hey, you know, there's a lot. They're still there. You know, we just need to they'll rally to the crown. So they stayed loyal throughout. And then the other movement that was pretty interesting and unique is just that partisan, just in the Carolinas, North and South Carolina, the Regulator movement, you know, the Piedmont areas, you know, less well off, you know, how they were, I guess, just particularly upset and inflamed at their unjust treatment by some of the more wealthy along the coastal towns, and how that went back and forth, and that played very heavily into this first round one of, we call it, with the British focusing on trying to capture this loyalist sentiment in the southern colonies.
Jerry, you begin your article with an introduction to the figure of Josiah Martin. Tell us about him.
He was the royal governor of North Carolina. He'd just been in the job for a few years, and he was his popularity was starting to wane, and a couple things that made him a little more difficult was, you know, because he was in his, in the early 70s, he was in, you know, mid 30s and late 30s, a little bit later, but he was stubborn, tactless, intolerant, that made him kind of a difficult fit for the already tense situation. He was extremely loyal, and he wrote to a number of letters that we go over in the articles of Lord Dartmouth, the colonial secretary of state in London for the colonies, trying to turn the tide, because he saw the population shifting, you know, from the assembly, and he could tell because he couldn't go in the streets anymore because, you know, they were demonstrating, calling him names. So he evacuates his family, you know, in 1774, he sends them to New York. But he sees this turning, and he writes these impassioned letters to try to get weapons to arm those that are loyal. And he's convinced up and so then they lose this one. But then later in 1780, he's with Cornwallis again. And that's part of the second wave of the Americanization of the South that he's continuing to say there's a lot of loyalist support here. And that does bear fruit the second time a little bit due to some other unique circumstances with the fall of Charleston and then the Gates infamous defeat at Camden, you know, where the American Continental Army was pretty much lost completely, save maybe 500 to 700 Continental regulars, and that's when the Green comes in.
Martin's going to have a lot on his plate as governor during this time. Could you maybe talk about some of the challenges that he had to juggle?
Well, he was the regulators, there were still some hard feeling, and he was trying to get them pardoned. Because he thought, well, we could work on the regulators and then the Scottish. There were thousands of them there because they had received some land grants. And he was trying to get them supported and just convince them that they needed to rally to the cause rather than just kind of stand by the sidelines. And the British knew that there was this large segment of the population. They thought, well, you know, if they don't rally to our cause necessarily, they'll at least won't jump on the side of the rebels and the patriots. So he is walking that fine line and trying to get military equipment and start training and raising troops. So he sent a couple of petitions out there, and then Thomas Gage commissioned a few, Donald McDonald and then Donald McLeod, veterans of the Battle of Bunker Hill, to lead their recruitment down there, and he sent them down south. And then the Patriots were aware of their presence, but they weren't arrested by the Committee on Safety. So, but they do come down and they start to recruit heavily.
Jerry, one of the things your article does really well is takes us through the pretty complicated political geography of North Carolina. Could you walk us through that?
Sure. So there were several. Some were recently immigrated, and they hadn't quite caught this rebellion bug. They were still very loyal to the crown. There were thousands, and they received, like I said, land grants, Scottish Highlanders, and they were primarily in the Piedmont area. And then regulators as well. And then the coastal areas was, they were a little more influential. And they were pretty much, and then there was a significant population of plantations and things like that. So they had some enslaved people as well. And so they had all these interesting dynamics. And, you know, most famously, the Virginia Lord Dunmore's Ethiopian regiment. So there wasn't anything like that going on in the Carolinas, at least. But these populations were not necessarily supportive of the rebellious government, but they also didn't want to be persecuted by their neighbors. And as the tide shifted and the lack of support without British regular troops in the area, they just kind of would fall back into the wayside just a little bit more. But yeah, Lord George Germain, British Secretary, a little bit later, begins the earnest conquest of the region again. He renews it a little bit later in 1778, which is interesting. That's the second round two, because there remained, as I said, a significant loyalist population, and thousands in North Carolina end up going to Canada after the war, in fact.
Jerry, tell us about the lead up to the Battle of Moore's Creek.
Sure. So Governor Martin is trying to get support and troops and regulars. And he's convinced London that 2,000 troops and enough, weapons, he would be able to actually outfit his loyalist group. And then the combined force could ensure that, North Carolina is firmly in British hands. So around that January, February timeframe, they're recruiting troops. Donald McDonald is doing a great job of equipping Scotsmen. And they're talking about up to 5,000 regulators and, 1,000 Scots is what's actually going to end up. They show up. But the interesting thing is when they learn that British regulars aren't there, they kind of start fading away. So they do answer about 3,000. End up showing up, and then they start fading away when they learn that they're not going to be going side by side with regulars, so they get a little bit nervous.
Okay, Jerry, we've set the stage a bit. Talk about the Battle of Moore's Creek.
Well, certainly. So the Battle of Moore's Creek Bridge was fought February 27th near Wilmington, North Carolina. And so the months leading up to January, February, they were the Patriots were recruiting soldiers and militia, and then Donald McDonald, who he had a bit of experience as a British officer during the Jacobite uprising of 1745, ended up with approximately 600 Scottish immigrants, and then 800 loyalists. Many were regulators. These were the regulators was an interesting group of people, the ones that typically attacked and protested unfair treatment by those wealthier landholders and larger plantation owners along the coast. And the governor Martin does ask that they be given a pardon to join the King's Standard, and he even writes, they join the King's Standard whatever they'd be called upon, but pardoning them, he suggested would ensure that they do that. On the 18th, MacDonald marched towards the coast to rendezvous with what he thought were going to be the British troops coming in from across the ocean. And Clinton was supposed to be there leading the troops, and they were going to support MacDonald, and Clinton were going to link up and support Martin, make sure he could safely travel around the city and then just quell the Patriot Rebellion. Patriots learned about this, and over 1,000 planned to stop him at the Black River that fed into the Cape Fear River. However, an enslaved person alerted MacDonald's that undefended crossing down at Moore's Creek, which was 17 miles from Wilmington. And then the militia leader, Colonel Richard Caswell, recorded a few details and talked about his 1,000-strong Minutemen and militia from the surrounding counties descended on Wilmington. And unfortunately for the Loyalists, Donald MacDonald fell ill. He was very experienced, and the command fell to a Lieutenant Colonel Donald MacLeod, who was less experienced, and he elected to attack the following morning. However, Caswell and the Patriots had removed the bridge planks and greased the stringers. So by the time the Loyalists arrived on the 27th, they learned as they headed towards the bridge that it was going to be difficult to cross. They start clashing with pickets, and Caswell's pickets that alerted the main force. And the Patriots had dug in, and they had artillery and cannons, and they were well prepared as the Loyalists approached. And the Loyalist group, they were short weapons as well, hence the broadswords. And then the Hollywood scene plays out as 600 Highlanders with tartan garments and feathers in their bonnets, wielding the claymores, the traditional Scottish broadswords, 4 or 5 feet, try to cross the bridge. Missing planks slow them down, and they get cut down. The cannon and musket fire just devastates them in the end. 50 Loyalists are killed. A couple do make it across the bridge, miraculously. But then the rest of them are pursued, and approximately 850 end up being captured. But up and down the Moore's Creek Bridge, for over 60 miles, there were various Patriots kind of watching, guarding, in case they shifted and tried to cross at a different location. So it was just absolutely devastating for those Loyalists.
Jerry, what happens in the aftermath of this battle? What does it change? How does the war become different after this?
And that's the most fascinating part of it. Following the victory, North Carolina was firmly in control of the Patriots. And this happens, throughout the conflict, and you see it a lot in the South. But it's true of any place else. When the Patriots win, right, they start, searching for Loyalists and root them out. So no one wants to be a Loyalist. So it's very difficult to recruit after that. And the Armada finally shows up. They've got various delays. In May, they arrive off Cape Fear, and Josiah Martin had said, "Hey, I don't have enough supporters to protect you as you come ashore to land," because it wasn't deep enough for the large ships to. So they were going to have to ferry much smaller vessels. And he said, "I just can't support you." So the British decide to abandon North Carolina. So they're off Cape Fear, and they decide, well, resistance is just too strong here. So it foils their plans in the South. So they lose North Carolina. And then Admiral Sir Peter Parker and General Henry Clinton divert south towards Charleston, South Carolina. They attempted the first assault in the city that ultimately failed on June 28, 1776. And they don't get that seaport. And obviously for London, seaports are significant assets and bases that they needed to secure. The Patriot victory secured American control and was a major deterrent for further Loyalist recruiting until the opening of the British Southern campaign almost 4 years later. After MacDonald's defeat, I said there were a number of Tories that would end up leaving once once they lost the war, but they were rather quiet and didn't really volunteer for fear of reprisal with their fellow citizens, because they were really vicious. This neighbor on neighbor conflict got out of hand, and it kind of is worse due to some of the history of the regulator raids and things like that.
Jerry, how does this article help us understand the Revolutionary Era better?
I think it's just amazing when you look at the mistakes that they made in London, and the Loyalist War, and it does look like in theory that this could have worked, right? But just this small event at this battle seems to seal the fate, and then obviously the British focus on the Northern campaign, right? And they try to isolate them for various conflicts, but the center being Boston, but the Northern colonies, they focus up there, and then many of the regions settled by in North Carolina, they were almost depopulated, like as I mentioned, towards the end of the conflict. But the Southern theater was the central operation in North America, the second half of the Revolutionary War, and that's why we're just calling this Round One, because Round Two happens when the Southern strategy and Americanization, because once 1778, the capture, Saratoga and France enters, as I alluded to earlier, most of the British regular troops are moved to the Caribbean. So they're short troops. So they look at the Americanization of the war effort. Again, George Germain wants to just secure these regions, essentially is his idea, and then put it in the hands of local loyalists who can run it once the mop-up operation is successful. So and this looks really good, actually, because we talked about how the the environment just shifts pretty dramatically. But if when you look at the history of it, the defeat of two of Continental armies in Charleston and then Camden, that just devastated the Continental forces. So increasingly, that small band is augmented by a number of militia. And then Nathaniel Greene takes over as this commander and does this Fabian strategy of avoidance against the British, which was just absolutely fascinating. And he's got a number of victories that tactically he loses, which is what I learned as I, did all that research. But he ends up weakening the British, and that culminates in the Battle of Guilford Courthouse. And then there are a number of American victories down there, Calpin, Kings Mountain, that kind of help, recruiting efforts for the Patriots. But initially, after the fall of both those armies, the Charleston and the Camden, and Gates's, horrible defeat, the people flocked to the Loyalist standard, and they had to just dedicate a couple of people to just training them and recruiting them when they were down in Charleston.
Jerry Krieger, thanks again.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
The music played in this episode included works by Kevin MacLeod and the Sturbridge Colonial Militia. Any unauthorized reproduction or use of this podcast without the express written permission of the Journal of the American Revolution is strictly prohibited. For everyone here at Dispatches, I'm Brady Kreitzer saying so long.